Hey, I'm Andrew Kirkendall here with Soho Insider on our MPN podcast. And today I have with me an esteemed guest, Mr. Doug Tremblay, coming from Mount Sinai. Doug, tell us a little bit about what you do up there at Mount Sinai and what your focus is.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Andrew. So I'm one of the more junior people in our group, but have been here for over a decade now, really focusing on MPNs and see a lot of patients across the entire MPN spectrum, and especially patients with essential thrombocythemia, and actively involved in a lot of the research activities we have going on up here. So it's really exciting to speak to you. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. So you mentioned ET. I think, you know, interestingly, I think it's having a bit of a moment right now. I think we've always, you know, from a research side of things, we've been very focused on myelofibrosis. And then I think polycythemia vera has been having a bit of a moment over the last few years, the development of agents there. Mastocytosis has been having a bit of a moment, and really ET has kind of been lost in the shuffle a bit. But more recently, I think there has been a lot more interest and activity, at least on the clinical research side of things with ET. And so kind of setting the stage, you know, ET is one of our classical myeloproliferative neoplasms. It really kind of exists on a spectrum, if you will, with polycythemia vera and myelofibrosis. You have the same driver mutations that JAK2, MPL, CALR that can drive this. But generally viewed as the less severe of the MPNs with the longest overall survival expectations, probably less of a symptom burden than we maybe see with polycythemia vera and myelofibrosis, but certainly a disease that can progress to myelofibrosis, maybe more rarely can progress to AML, and does come with an increased risk of thrombotic events, which really is where our kind of a treatment paradigm has historically fallen. So Doug, why don't you walk us through how we approach ET, just kind of the general approach to managing patients with essential thrombocythemia.
Great. So, you know, the first thing I do whenever a patient walks into the clinic with ET is really think about what their risk status is. And when we speak about risk status, what we're really speaking about is risk of thrombosis. And so there's several different risk stratification methods, but they all really rely on three clinical factors in general, which is age, prior thrombosis, which is probably the most potent risk factor, and then the presence of a JAK2 mutation, which in ET is a significant risk factor for eventual thrombosis. So patients who are higher risk are those who have had a prior thrombosis or who are older and have a JAK2 mutation. What we're really thinking about is medications like cytoreductive therapies. But before that, basically all patients should really be placed on aspirin, with some exceptions, those patients who have very high platelet counts and concern for acquired von Willebrand's disease, or patients who are extremely very low risk. So younger patients, no thrombosis, without a JAK2 mutation. So aspirin for most patients. And then again, those older patients, it's really about cytoreductive agents. And that mostly means hydroxyurea, but there's also data for pegylated interferon and other interferon formulations in this disease. And so really thinking about risk stratification and then which patients are appropriate for these cytoreductive therapy options is how I go about talking about treatment with patients.
Yeah, I think you mentioned, right, that certainly the focus historically has been on reducing thrombotic risk, right? This is something that, you know, probably in the short term is, and even the medium to long term, right, is you know, what we think we can accomplish within this disease and to kind of reduce maybe more negative outcomes. And we do that with antiplatelet therapy, sometimes antithrombotic therapy, as well as some cytoreductive strategies. Is there a world where we want to move beyond just thinking about thrombotic risk, right? Like, I think that this is a disease that, you know, patients have expressed, maybe they have other concerns. So are there other clinically meaningful outcomes? Like, you know, throw away like feasibility, right, with some of these things, but what would you be interested in being able to accomplish with patients with ET?
Yeah, it's a great point, Andrew, because we often think about thrombosis because we know it is the leading contributor to both morbidity and mortality in patients with ET. But patients often have other concerns. And this is highlighted well in a lot of MPN landmark survey study, for instance, that they're really concerned about delaying and preventing the disease from progressing. Many patients I have speak about feeling like they're a ticking time bomb and one day that this is going to turn into a much more significant disease. So a goal, I think, of the next generation of therapies is really about trying to delay the natural history of the disease, which is disease progression, either worsening of the ET phenotype or progressing to a different disease category like myelofibrosis or AML. So disease progression is an endpoint that, while you mentioned may not be feasible, is something that I think is a more of a North Star that we should really be looking for. Other things that patients with ET experience, which may not be as severe as a thrombosis, but accumulating over every day a patient experiences can be really significant is things like constitutional symptoms. And so constitutional symptoms, like you mentioned, may be less prevalent in ET patients as compared to myelofibrosis patients or likely PV patients. But many patients still suffer from microvascular symptoms like headaches or vision changes or auras, as well as other cytokine-related symptoms like itching and night sweats and fevers and the ever-present fatigue, which most patients, even non-MPN patients, experience a lot. So I think improving symptoms in patients is another kind of goal that we should really be focusing on. And then, you know, more of a surrogate for some of the disease progression, which I mentioned, is that the disease is really driven in the majority of cases by these driver mutations. And if we could maybe eliminate those driver mutations or at least reduce the burden of them, that might lend itself to more long-term control of the disease, which would follow with less thrombosis, less symptoms, and maybe less disease progression. So those are some of the other endpoints that I think are being evaluated in the next generation of ET therapies.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said a lot of good things there. We're obviously, you know, we're always thinking about like what live longer, live better, right? And, you know, for a long time, we said, you know, we focused on thrombotic risk reduction because that's really what we could do. And we know that that was accomplished. You know, we know hydroxyurea has at least a phase three trial looking at that. You know, baby aspirin, I think we're extrapolating a bit from data from PV, but still has that antiplatelet kind of approach. And certainly there's a symptomatic benefit to baby aspirin actually in ET for a lot of patients. But yeah, I mean, focusing on symptoms and focusing on delaying progression, right? We haven't really focused on that because it's a really difficult thing to do within the context of a trial, right? Progression occurs in a subset of patients and it may take 15 or 20 years for that to happen. So it's not really a realistic thing to look at. But maybe we have surrogates now that we understand a little bit more about driver mutations, VAF reductions, the variant allele fraction reductions, right? And maybe we're starting to get a preponderance of data that suggests that if we can significantly lower the driver mutation allele fractions, that probably does convey a better or protective outcome. And so now the question is like, how do we accomplish those things, right? Do we actually have therapies that can meaningfully reduce that? And I think we're starting to get data there. So without further ado, I want to move into kind of the excitement in the field. You know, at both EHA, the European meeting in Milan, as well as at ASCO in Chicago, we had big ET presentations, right? That's not something that we talk about too much, but you know, the first one I'd like to highlight is the SURPASS-ET study. So this was looking at ROPEG interferon in patients with essential thrombocythemia. So can you give us a brief summary of the SURPASS-ET study and try to like put this in context of what do we gain from this? What do we understand now that we didn't know before?
Great. So in terms of options for cytoreductive therapy, we mentioned hydroxyurea. I briefly mentioned that there's older interferon formulations available. And then there's another drug, a selective platelet reducing drug, anagrelide, which is somewhat used in ET, but has a lot of toxicity associated with it, and it's kind of unclear role. So what the SURPASS-ET study really asked is, if you have patients who have ET and they're resistant or intolerant to hydroxyurea, which is better, anagrelide or this newer interferon formulation, ROPEG interferon, which is approved now for polycythemia vera. So it took patients, 174 patients, and who were resistant or intolerant to hydroxyurea and never received an interferon before, and then randomized them to either ROPEG interferon or anagrelide, which would be one of the standard therapies. And what they really looked for was a response, which was defined by normalization of blood counts, as well as no thrombotic or progression events, and some improvement in symptoms. And what they found was that ROPEG interferon was significantly better than anagrelide at achieving that control of these disease components. Specifically, about 43% of patients in the ROPEG arm versus 6% of patients in the anagrelide arm hit this primary endpoint of this ELN response. And even those different components of the responses were significantly better. And the other finding that I think is noteworthy is that there was a significant reduction in the JAK2 allele burden, which we understand from polycythemia vera. But an interesting fact too was a feature was in the patients who had a calreticulin mutation, there was also a significant reduction in calreticulin variant allele frequency at 12 months in the ROPEG group versus those who were treated with anagrelide, which in prior studies had kind of suggested that interference may be less effective at molecular responses in calreticulin mutated patients. But in this trial, there was a difference between the two of them. So where this really fits in is that this is really introduces that ropeg interferon is an effective therapy in patients with essential thrombocythemia who are resistant or tolerant to frontline hydroxyurea, and that this is really a therapy that's probably better than what we frequently use, which is a anagrelide. So kind of suggests that this could be entered into the treatment armamentarium with a lot more confidence than we had based on the kind of smaller, older formulation studies of pegylated interferon.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, in my practice, and maybe yours is similar, I think certainly do use a lot of hydroxyurea for these patients. You know, we use a lot of pegylated interferon as well. And so now with ROPEG, you know, we knew that we had an approval for PV, hadn't really been looked at in ET. You know, I assumed it probably had benefit there. So I think this kind of justifies that and maybe shows a little bit more upside, right, with this treatment as opposed to alternative. So I think this is kind of just a further nail in the coffin when it comes to anagrelide, unfortunately. A drug that I use that much anyways, but now I think further less reason to use it anyways. And so I do want to touch a bit on what probably is one of the more exciting developments in this space, which is the development of CALR targeted therapies. And certainly there's a lot going on, right? We know that there's been vaccine studies that were initially done, right? There's monoclonal antibodies, which we'll touch on. There's T cell redirecting antibodies that maybe have a bit more activation or engagement of the immune system, even discussions of maybe development of CAR T cells for CALR. But we got our first data dump, right? So our first data came out from the CALR antibody, monoclonal antibody that's being developed, looking at an ET and myelofibrosis. But what we saw at EHA was maybe the first look at this dose escalation study in patients with ET. And so I'll briefly summarize kind of my takeaway, but I want to hear what yours was as well. You know, I think what we saw is that, you know, in this study of ET patients, this monoclonal antibody was able to kind of quickly reduce platelet counts to a normal range without causing much thrombocytopenia. I think that's interesting. Also saw some improvements in other blood counts as well. Now, a lot of ET patients, a lot of them, you know, have relatively normal blood counts, but we saw some improvements in hemoglobin. And then we saw, I think what was interesting, some reduction in this CALR variant allele fraction. I think, you know, that's a moving target, is exactly how best to define that, because I think there's still debates on how clinically significant and what constitutes a clinically significant reduction. But yeah, you know, what's your overall thoughts? I think, you know, obviously in a dose escalation study, you know, we're dealing with kind of a wide dosing range. I think in this, we had 100-fold, you know, different doses, yep, right? From 25 or so up to 2,500 or something. But yeah, what's your overall excitement level? Where do you see this going in ET specifically?
Yeah, I'm extremely excited about this approach. And I think a few aspects that make me particularly excited is what you mentioned, that it doesn't really cause thrombocytopenia. So if you gave increasing doses of most of the drugs that we use right now, you would get thrombocytopenia after the dose increases to a certain level, but that was not seen here too. And the variant allele frequency decreases were really interesting, but I was also really struck by what they showed with the changes in the bone marrow histomorphology and really in some of the representative bone marrow biopsy slides that they had after treatment, there was a significant reduction in the mutant CALR megakaryocytes, and then a significant improvement in the normal megakaryocytes that were wild type. And even looking at the bone marrows, if you look at patients' bone marrow biopsies with ET, you see these very characteristic megakaryocytes and hyperplasia and hypertrophy. And you don't really see that with the after treatment. Obviously, these are small numbers, but it's really exciting to see that it's reversing not just some of the peripheral blood findings of ET, but actual the histomorphology, how the disease appears under the microscope.
I mean, so dare I say we're entering an era where we might be seeing disease modification? I don't know. I mean, that's a buzzword. We've kind of avoided saying it so far. I thought you were going to say it earlier, but
I flirted with it actually. Get there. So yeah, it's certainly suggestive. I mean, what that really means and how much this really translates is not well established. But I think that if you were thinking about a intervention and you had a wish list of things that you would like it to do, this really checks off a lot of those buckets.
Yeah, I think there's still obviously a lot of questions that still are answered. I think this is a tough space to develop a therapy, right, with ET. We're not really sure what a clinically meaningful outcomes are. Just if you normalize platelets, is that enough? But we allow patients' platelets to be kind of consistently high. So we don't necessarily think it's like a super clinically important outcome just to normalize platelets. But if you're changing the biology of the disease, if you're reducing consistently CALR VAFs, can you get them to go away? Can you get the CALR mutations to like less than 10, less than 5%? I think these are all things that You know, we're going to have to come together as a community to figure out and establish the clinical relevance of these things. But I think certainly exciting. And, you know, when you're changing what the bone marrow looks like, that's a lot better than what our standard approaches do. So
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, it also suggests, I mean, you can imagine a world where you use this sort of therapy, almost like an induction where you start reducing it and then more of a maintenance phase. And it's really kind of opens up a lot of possibilities out there. Yeah. So we're at the early days right now, but it's exciting.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of questions exactly like how durable are these responses? How long do they last? Is there a treatment-free period you could have? Like, you know, I think all these things are going to be, you know, we're really early on, but I think it's fun to start to ask some of these questions. So with that, I think, Doug, this has been an awesome conversation about ET and really appreciate you bringing your kind of approach and opinions of this new data that's coming out. So tell us what you're working on right now that you're excited about in your clinic and in your research portfolio.
Yeah, you know, so we're looking at a lot of things with ET, especially because there's a lot of data with interferons, with older formulations of interferons. And it's kind of an age-old question, which one do you choose in the frontline setting? And so we're really looking at, is there a real benefit to early interferon use? Because the data that was presented here really looks at second-line interferons. But what about moving that earlier in the treatment landscape? So we're doing a lot of projects kind of looking at that as well, too. So there's also a lot of distinctions, too, between ET and prefibrotic myelofibrosis, too, that is not really well understood. So trying to distinguish those two with different kind of like AI learning techniques is something that we're excited to explore as well.
I'm with you. I think we're very interested in these CALR approaches, whether it's monoclonal antibodies. I think we're interested in some of the T-cell redirecting antibodies as well, getting a better understanding of, you know, how do we best target CALR? And you know, at the same time, you know, is this something that can really move the needle and replace our kind of treatment paradigm that we've been so used to? So I really appreciate it, Doug. Again, here with Soho Insider on this podcast where we focused on ET and some of these emerging developments that are super exciting. Thanks for listening.